Correct. I'm always big on that, right? Try to explain to, like, this is not me saying this, and people get angry at me, and I'm always the opposite. Be like, don't you want a chance? If this is what this is in anything, don't you want a chance to be able to respond if this is what people in the league are saying about you or give your side?
You're listening to the Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
Brian O'Leary here with you. Today on our podcast, we have Yaron Weitzman, who recently wrote a book called A Hollywood Ending, The Dreams and Drama of the LeBron Lakers, published by Doubleday on October 21st, 2025. In the interview, we get into the book quite a bit and talk about it. It's become a hot topic here in NBA circles. If you're into that, I think you'll gain a lot of insight here, what's happening with the Lakers and the NBA. And we just thank Yaron for joining us, taking some time out of his day to join us, talk about the book. It was a good conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. If you want to, please follow me on X or Twitter, formerly known as, I guess you say, YouTube and Substack, all at Brian D. O'Leary. And you can go to the Substack at O'LearyReview.com. That'll get you there also. So stay tuned for Yaron Weitzman talking about A Hollywood Ending, The Dreams and Drama of the LeBron Lakers. All right, Brian O'Leary here with you. Yaron Weitzman wrote a new book, A Hollywood Ending, The Dreams and Drama of the LeBron Lakers, Doubleday Press. Here it is. Came out on October 21st and already got some controversy brewing, it looks like.
What?
So we'll get into that in a second, I think. But Wait. What first drew you to become a basketball writer?
Basketball writer. Ooh, that's different. I like that. What first drew me? I love basketball. It's been always, I'm one of the, it's funny. I have a 6-year-old boy. I have three kids. I have a 6-year-old though. And I say he reminds me of me, and you see it with some kids. I'm starting to see it. Like some kids just have that sports bug. And that was me. There was obsessed with it. They want to soak everything of all sports in at all times. Right. So that was always me. Yeah. And just always like, you know, I want to work in sports. Didn't even know what that meant, you know, and basketball was the sport I always loved most. I actually thought, you know, I talked a lot about this in my last book tour because with the Sixers book kind of process, because it kind of related to that. But I say I grew up in the Moneyball fantasy sports age, right? So where fan and the blog age where fans started consuming things from the perspective of GMs. Like you think about what would I do if I was running the team? And that was sort of a change. So for me, I wanted to be a GM. That was always it. And then I went to NYU and studied sports management there. And sort of midway through, though, I realized, like, actually, I'm drawn to the sociological aspects and the games themselves and just the stories around sports. Like, that's the stuff I love. So I started writing for the NYU paper, local paper. I always joke that to this day, no one's been meaner to me or rougher on me than the cheerleading moms at Scarsdale High School who thought I didn't adequately cover their daughters. And they accused me of, like, favoritism, not understanding that it was just a 9 p.m. deadline, you know? And yeah, but basketball was always what I wanted to be. I just always loved basketball the most. I understood it the most. I wasn't great, but probably my best sport. And yeah, just kind of chased it.
And so you mentioned you wrote the book about the Sixers that came out a couple of years ago, The Process. That's for another book tour a couple years ago. But shall we say, is there any connection, personal or otherwise, to the Lakers that got you interested in this topic?
No, like no personal connection other than, honestly, I live in New York. I've rarely written about the Lakers, rarely written about LeBron. Sort of I call it my day job career. Like my day job, when I write, you know, daily coverage or monthly at this point, I like to think I zag more than zig. And I've never felt that there was never a lack of LeBron coverage, right? Or Lakers coverage. Never felt like someplace for me to add my voice or my thoughts. Which is ironic because actually for the book, I felt it was sort of the opposite, that being sort of an outsider and meaning coming at things from a different perspective. And also the way I phrase it is like, when I cover games, I go to Madison Square Garden. I don't need a credential from the Lakers. If they literally never give one to me again, it will not impact my career at all, really at all, because I live in New York. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean I was coming like ready to like burn bridges and torch everything, but it just meant that I knew I could approach this with a critical eye, right? And just write things the way I saw them and not worry about repercussions.
Yeah. And as mentioned at the time, a little controversy, I imagine it happened a while back, but recently, just after publication, news comes up again that the Lakers tried to stop publication of this book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I don't know why. I'll fast forward to the end. I'm not sure why. So the background is, you know, I start doing this book. I reach out to the principals, Jeannie Buss, the owner of the Lakers, LeBron's people,
You started this like 2022 or so.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
Correct. So LeBron's people I've described as sort of a very pleasant thanks but no thanks, right? Not aggressive, just decline, but you know, do you. Jeannie, I met with a couple times off the record. I met with her in a LA diner and like at Vegas Summer League. At a hotel, I forget which hotel, but one of the hotel restaurants. Just, it was sort of my, and then I'll explain why I'm okay talking about it, but just sort of my, you know, this is sort of my pitch. Like, hey, let me meet you. Here's my idea. I'm doing the book. Let me tell you more about me. They don't know me. Let me tell you more about me. Here's how I approach things. Why don't you get to know me? I'll give you my thoughts. You can ask me any question you want. We can talk, yada, yada. You know, it's almost like, you know, you're trying to sell them, right? On you. And then you're trustworthy, right? So it's a bit of that. You're putting on an act, right? Sort of like a first date, honestly, in a weird way. And that's not because she was a woman, right? That's the same if it's with a male owner. So and I do that. And then we also do a little fact checking in those, like informal, sort of I'm telling her, yeah, here's what I heard. And she's giving her thoughts. And I don't reveal this because I was transcribing in the interview. I saw she did like this long form interview with this guy out in LA.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book. Was it Graham Bensinger?
Yeah, yeah. Right. So I'm transcribing it because this is what I have my alerts. Anytime Jeannie Buss, you know, I'm looking at it, research. And all of a sudden I'm listening and she goes, yeah. And there's this writer who's doing a book on us who told me that you run a cheap organization or bare bones, I forget what she said. And I'm like, okay, I guess these aren't off. I guess we're talking about these meetings now. I don't know. I guess off the record's done. Cool. Works for me. So we do that.
She wanted off the record at the beginning or was that you or were you just getting back?
I offer it, but she wanted it. But I just, you know, again, that's very standard, especially for like an initial. Hey, I'm writing this big picture. I'm working on this big picture project. Let's just like talk. No recorders, no notes. It's like, let's get dinner and talk, right?
Let's dive into that allegation too. That say, what do you say? Cheap. But it's not your words. It's your words coming from somebody else.
Correct. I'm always big on that. Right? I try to explain like, this is not me saying this. And people get angry at me. And I'm always the opposite. Be like, don't you want a chance? If this is what, this is in anything. Don't you want a chance to be able to respond if this is what people in the league are saying about you or give your side?
Yeah, I was talking with a fellow who has been in the league for a long time, and this is a while ago, but he was telling me that the Lakers have always been known as a mom and pop shop, not necessarily cheap, but I think you do mention it in the book. It's like the Buss family, that's their deal. It's the Lakers. It's mom and pop. But it's in this envelope of glitz and glamour of LA and Hollywood ending as you right in your title, but it is a mom and pop shop. It's a family run organization that doesn't really have much outside of sports, and the Lakers is the main vehicle for them to earn money. And you know, I guess we can get into them selling the franchise in a bit. But anyway, continue about Jeannie.
Yeah, I want to come back to the mom and pop because I have some thoughts on that. We'll come back to that. So anyway, so I do that, and then at some point, I don't know. She stops answering text, which is fine. But like, it was so informal that, you know, I live in New Rochelle and she was very excited that, I should have told the story more, but she was very excited that, you know, New Rochelle, Dick Van Dyke, right? So the Dick Van Dyke show was in New Rochelle and I don't jog anymore, but there was a point where I was attempting jogging and it's about a half mile away from me is there's a street and Dick Van Dyke Way or whatever it's named after him. So I remember jogging and taking a picture and sending it to her and her being all excited that I remembered. So anyway, we were very cordial. Somewhere along the line, I start hearing she's really worried, you know, from sources, she's really worried. It's some kind of, you know, just paranoia or whatever reaction to something's happening.
Now, what's the timeline here? Is this still 2022 or is this?
No, we're like 2 years later. We're about May 2024, whatever that finals were, because not long after game one of the finals, it's the year the Celtics, who they beat. I don't remember they beat the Mavericks. Right. And so actually it's game one. And the funny part is the day the news breaks that the Lakers are chasing Dan Hurley. So that day I'm covering the finals for Fox Sports and I'm on the sideline and I see an inbox like pregame. I see an email in my inbox. It says from the desk of Marty Singer. Hi, I'm Marty Singer, represent the Lakers. And I don't know who this is, but I Google him. And it's very clear very quickly that he's a very famous and aggressive defamation lawyer known in LA. So by that point, I'm like, okay, informal communications cut off. And then later on, I send them fact checking, right? That's what happens. You send them fact checking.
Now, at this point, had you shared anything other than?
No, that's the price. So if you were to ask her, this is the thing. If someone were to ask her, she would say, well, I knew what they were going to write. And because we look at all these things, the fact checking stuff, which they were sensitive to, we can get to that. But this was before they got fact checking. So they hired this lawyer this defamation lawyer, this lawyer known for aggressively chasing defamation cases before they had received any fact checking. So I know usually people hear through the grapevine, sources talk, whatever, some things get back, but they had no idea what would be in the book or what the angle of the book was before they reached out.
Yeah, being unfamiliar, I mean, mildly familiar with your previous book, I haven't read it, but was there any blowback from the Sixers organization or the NBA in general with this defamation stuff? Or, I mean, not really defamation, but from the Sixers or the NBA or players?
What, after the Sixers book, you mean? After the Sixers book, no, ownership was worried before. Like they brought in Josh Harris's like fancy, he's the owner of the Sixers. They brought him his fancy New York PR firm, like not a Sixers. I had a meeting in his, you know, which clearly the people he uses for like the outside, you know, let's say Apollo or not Apollo or whatever dealings he have there. But honestly, that was a whole different thing. No, it was really okay. Brett Brown yelled at me on the phone for 10 minutes. He was the coach. Owner. Then when the book came out, I think they saw it was fine. Joel Embiid was not happy with me and still not. Similar thing, just writing about stuff that's true. Just he's sensitive about like how much he eats or his weight. I'm sensitive to the fact that when you get the fact checking, the way the fact checking works is, if we're not having constant communication, that's why I'm always saying, let's just get on the phone and talk. But if you're not having it, you get this document that has 40 or 50 points. They're all negative because I don't need a fact check person X saying Jeannie Buss is a great owner. I don't need Jeannie Buss' reaction to that. That's going to be cool.
So who puts together the fact check document? Is that you or your...
I mean, they review, but I do. It's me, right? And it's mostly like, you know, things that probably worry them or don't look great. You know, we have reporting that staffers had to pay their own way to summer league. You know, what do you want to say? This, a bunch of lists like that. So the answer is always, and I've done this with other people, usually you get on the phone and if there's, sometimes it could be context missing or there could be reason something you're missing. And I always say, I'm really happy to change it, right? Like it's not, this is before publication. So if you give me a reason to show me where I'm missing context or where, you know, the example, I said I can't share examples specifically because some of the other stuff was done with people off the record, but like there are examples where context is shared. You're like, you know what? I didn't think about that. That's a good point. Cool. Done. Out. Like, that's great.
Yeah.
Like,
you footnote that example too, if I recall, where they're like, well, they weren't part of the.
So some of the responses, so they sent me this list, their responses, and some of them are just ridiculous, not factual, like just little things like, and some of them are footnote in the book, but just things that when you start saying person X didn't know person Y, even though person Y has told people that person X was his kid's godparent, right? Things like that. Like it's like we're not dealing with reality here.
The Kurt Rambis, which I wanted to get into the Kurt Rambis thing a little bit. You should mention it was a trainer or something that Kurt Rambis' wife, which I'd heard Linda Rambis' name thrown. I didn't realize what a big deal she was in the Lakers organization. How, I mean, other than being friends with Jeannie Buss, how does a wife of Kurt Rambis become such a power player? And then Kurt becomes such a power player in the Lakers organization, you know, after, I mean, he had a wonderful career with the Lakers, but he bounced around a little bit afterwards. And then he was their coach, you know, in crisis mode basically for a little bit in the 90s. I think it was the 90s. And then, he was an assistant for Phil Jackson for many years.
I'm going to cut you off. I think it's the opposite. It's more like, it's not the wife. In Lakers world, it's going to sound crazy. Or in Jeannie Buss's world, Kurt Rambis is Linda Rambis's husband. Like it's the...
That's what it sounded like.
That's where the power is. It's not the opposite, right?
Right.
It's the powers that... I mean, it's the most Lakers story, right? So Linda Rambis, how does she get involved in this world? Because her older sister, I believe, was a playmate. Or Playboy Bunny, I should say, excuse me. A Playboy Bunny dated, in quotes, Jerry Buss, whatever that means at that point, right? One of his girlfriends. And Jerry got to know Linda. And then when Jeannie gets started, he brings Linda in to start working in then the forum and kind of helping her as a right-hand woman. And the two of them do amazing things, like around the Los Angeles Strings, the tennis team. Like they're just...
Well, she went that far back with them. Okay. Wow. Okay.
And working, like, I know sometimes it becomes a cliche, but being woman in sports at that time, like that in back offices, like that was not easy. Sexism's an understatement, right? Just like, it just, not even, I mean, Jeannie went to an owner's meeting once and got someone grabbed her behind. Like there's literally stuff like that. But even earlier on, it wasn't just overt, just like, you know, all the classic Mad Men style stuff, right? So dealing with that was tough. And Linda and Jeannie become, I don't want to say best friends, but really, really close. And someone Jeannie relies on and trusts. And the part about Linda, it's interesting, is like, I think by this point, like she is qualified to do like these things that people say she does, not necessarily make basketball decisions, but talk to agents and be involved. She's been around lots of important people, lots of successful people, the Lakers world, the Forum, like these important centers of sporting and culture universe for decades. The thing that's weird is this sort of genie either doesn't realize how much she does or just lies about how much she does. So like I have, you know, agents speak to Linda Rambis and I find this out not because I'm some great reporter, because you could call up, you could, you know, flip a Rolodex to a random page of an agent, say, hey, have you ever spoken to Linda Rambis? They're going to be like, yeah, right. She speaks to that many. And the Lakers and Jeannie Buss insist that never happens. Right. And weird stuff like that, where I don't know. It seems like to me, if you just said what her job was.
Did you get a chance to talk to Linda at all?
No.
They call him the Rambi. I thought that was interesting. Where'd you get that?
I don't know. It's an NBA world term, the Rambi. Yeah. I love it. I think it's perfect.
Yeah, I loved it too. Yeah. So you mentioned you talked to, you know, like a lot of these folks, you're getting information from the people who talk to people type thing. And you mentioned Clutch. That's a whole another thing that I appreciate, the, you know, the in-depth nature of what you did there. I didn't know the whole story, but you spent several chapters, or at least parts of chapters, going into the Clutch thing. Did you ever get to talk to LeBron himself?
For 20 seconds, I told him, I'm doing this book, you know, and I told your guy's name's Adam Mendelsohn. He's this communications guy. Like, I ran through him. He's like, yep, I'm good. Run it through Adam. And that was that. LeBron doesn't do, they don't really do long form interviews at all anymore. You know, it's kind of saving it for the documentary. And I have no issue with that. Like, that's sort of,
It's changed a lot. I was talking to a fella who worked in the, you know, the NBA for years as a beat writer, and he was telling me that, man, these guys, when you used to come to town or they came to your town, the stars would want to talk to the local beat writer because they wanted to get, you know, more or less wanted to get positive coverage of them. And now I don't know the dynamic has certainly changed since the 80s or 90s even. And I think it is largely because these guys make so much money and they have so much power just by virtue of making all this money now. But
and social media, you can get their messages out, or player run podcasts. Like, they don't need a reporter. I mean, but even look at books, right? So it's funny, if you look at a bunch of successful NBA books, so you can look mine, I've never spoken to the main subjects. Miron Fader wrote a bestseller book on Giannis. Didn't speak to him. Chris Herring, who wrote a bestseller book on the Knicks, on the 90s Knicks, jokes at like the four pick main faces on his cover. He didn't speak to them. Jeff Perlman, when he did his Kobe Shaq, he spoke to Shaq, not Kobe. This is just like, it's the world we live in now, honestly. It's just how it goes.
Yeah. So, you know, I have a contention that journalism and sports journalism in particular is certainly dying as opposed to where it used to be. So how did you, or why did you even choose to publish this thing?
It was the end of it. And I'm not going to pretend it's not scary, but like the idea that there's defamation there is just absurd, right? Forget even, I mean, first of all, the definition of defamation is just, you know, I know we live in a new America, but you have to basically do it. Lie purposely is basically it. And like, that would be crazy. And this stuff's all fact-checked and verified and, like, multiple sources. Like, I felt comfortable with it. And
did you have an idea where this story would go when you first started it, or an agenda of any sort?
No agenda. I kind of had a feeling it would get a little, I'm going to say, I had a feeling there was some, I hate this term, but, like, dirt that'd be found, just because it's just obvious that the way these things are run and the relationship was always a little messy. And that, you know, I learned early on, I think I say it's in the prologue, like, a big part of the story is, I think I call it, like, a story about storytellers in a story that they tell about themselves, right? And like, so much of LeBron and Rich Paul and the Lakers, Jeannie and her father Jerry, so much about like, they're myth makers, right? And a lot of it is stuff that they're building up, and that's part of their brands, and they make money off of that. And as a journalist, you're like, I'm not here to tear down myths, but I'm a believer in like, what's the truth? And not, you know, I remember talking to people about LeBron, and like, it's not that I'm trying to tear down LeBron. And even when you make fun of some of these things went viral about some of his you know, lack of authenticity, we should say, around like how he reads books or whatever. And you write that not because you want to make fun of LeBron, but because LeBron's this important cultural icon who I think, if we're talking about like this stretch, like that the fact that he was often photographed having what, like holding books that were clearly not read, I think that's part of his story, right? It just is.
Yeah. So you mentioned the prologue. Let's talk about that a little bit. How you have a conversation in there. And So what was the biggest challenge there to verify it was real, or is it more the story that you're concerned with?
No, so we did it again, talking about like specific, we can get journalism. Like, so if I'm recreating something in the book, it's in italics. That I was there for that. So I was in the locker room for that conversation. The prologue, I'll give the background here. So this is, it's one of these great, like, journalism, you show up 100 times, you never know. But one time you just keep showing up. And sometimes you strike gold. And I was in Miami for a Lakers game, a random game. I just happened to be there. I think I was visiting like my, you know, classic, you know, New York to Miami winter break game. Right. And I'm visiting. And so I go to the Lakers Heat game, and I'm not a beat writer, so I forget who was speaking, but the game was over. And let's say it was Austin Reeves. I don't know, whoever, Anthony Davis, somebody's going to the podium. So all the beat writers go. It couldn't be Anthony Davis, he was left behind, but someone goes, all the beat writers go. And I'm the only reporter left in the locker room. And LeBron, Anthony Davis, and Jared Vanderbilt, another teammate, and a couple staffers are there. And I'm still there. And so, like, I'm not hiding. I'm not shoving my phone in LeBron's face, but I'm just kind of like, my credentials out. So I'm very clean, right? But they start talking, having this conversation about, you know, which contract meant the most when you signed it. And it evolves into, how much do you think you're worth? And I'm just running my recorder being like, oh my God, this is gold. I'm just kind of standing on the side, letting it go. And I go home that night and I transcribe. I remember sending it to my brother and him being like, oh, that's your prologue. And I'm like, oh my God, you're right. Just, it was the idea of LeBron talking about how much he's worth and why he thinks he's worth that and what his value is. And to me, it was just, it was luck. I guess the not lucky part is, you know, you go, you show up, and that's what you get. But there was some luck to that. So that was all recorded and listening to very carefully, like, over and over to make sure I get the words right.
Yeah, no, that's gold. Yeah, let's talk about LeBron for a second and like how much he is worth. My contention, you know, you hear it thrown around that LeBron is a fraud, or that LeBron is the greatest of all time. I don't know that either is exactly true. I lean more toward the fraud part, because I think my contention.
Look at you.
Yeah, my contention is that he is a gifted, supremely gifted athlete. The likes of Bo Jackson, Dan Kendra, Goliath, perhaps. Like, you don't see many of these guys out in the wild. And, you know, he's been, what, is his 21st year, 22nd year, something like that. And there's a reason he's lasted so long. And even Chael Sonnen, MMA guy, has intimated that his guy is LeBron's guy. And you don't touch on any of this in the book. I think it would, you know, for speculation, I don't mean speculation, but why didn't you dive into that? Which is, it's a more or less open secret.
I would disagree. Okay, so again, goes back to like why I was comfortable publishing a book, and you know, that to me is the idea that LeBron is taking performance enhancing. Yeah, if you talk to like five scouts, they'll be, oh, I heard about this, or not. You know, not everyone says that, but to me, I don't know. I only write things I know. So unless it's get his trainer or somebody, I know that's not how they do it anymore, but somebody literally seeing him get injected in the rear, right, in the locker room.
Right. It's not like the days of Mark McGwire. And
correct. So I don't know. So I just, to me, it's one of these things where I didn't have it. And I don't personally care so much. Honestly, I think it's different. Like, what, I mean, this is made up science. I don't, what's, if you were using it, like, what's the difference between, I don't know, HGH or whatever, the 90 million minerals and nutrients he's taking anyway when his supplement on it. Like, I don't, to me, like, LeBron's longevity, and I make sure to cover this because it's something I wanted to really hit on the book. It's a result of his discipline and his commitment to being great for a long time. And like the willingness, playing is easy. Everyone says, like, playing, even when you're old, like playing in the game, that's easy. It's the commitment and the discipline it takes to remaining at a high level, meaning you're getting your sleep and you're not going out. And at 220, you're going to get your massage and you're going to interrupt your card game. Like, someone joked to me that, like, there's something that's looking around, look, seems like his trainer has like a trap door because it pops out with his like 420 salmon and quinoa, right? And Michael Beasley joked to me that it's like there's a bleeping NASCAR pit stop around him at all times. Like, it's this level of discipline. You know, you see LeBron showing up for the podcast, and maybe it's showy, but he's coming when he does his podcast with Steve Nash and JJ Redick. He's got his giant, like, I love this. They're drinking wine, and to me, it's very obvious. He's bringing his giant jug of water, and it's like, oh, he's definitely thought that I'm drinking wine on this podcast, but I know in his head, he's thinking every glass of wine I have, I need to drink this much ounces of water. That's how I make it. So that to me is what the greatness is from.
Yeah. And, you know, well, I mean, we could get into that and everything. I mean, Kobe Bryant went to Germany. Now he just goes to Germany, and that's the last you hear of that. Well, there's some scientists that have been doing things since the 1960s. But anyway, it's well, let's leave that be. You talk clutch, we mentioned earlier too, and Clutch is the agency owned by Rich Paul, who was LeBron met him in high school, I guess it was, or right after high school.
Yeah, and LeBron was in high school at an airport. He met him. He saw him. Rich was selling throwback jerseys.
And Paul becomes this lawyer or this agent, and becomes massively successful, basically on the back of LeBron. And then the Lakers have been accused of being an agency team because of Rob Pelinka's being the GM of the Lakers, being an ex-agent, and his relationship with Rich Paul. And Lakers have signed a bunch of clutch guys with a, you know, maybe perhaps as they could have taken somebody else, but when push comes to shove, you're going to take the clutch guy. Is that because of LeBron, Rich Paul, the relationship between Pelinka and Paul, or none of the above?
No, the relationship between Pelinka and Paul is, like, in recent years was not great. So two parts. One, I would say one of the things that going back was interesting is, like, the idea that Clutch running the Lakers was overblown. And you can look, the most obvious examples in 2019, LeBron's second year, like before any issues, second year, he wants Ty Lue as the head coach. They basically say no. Right? And LeBron wanted the Lakers to trade for Kyrie Irving. Like, they've said no to him on a lot of big things. Where they've said yes is more smaller things. I think that's sort of interesting and telling. It's sort of like, well, this is where the agency and the Hollywood stuff. Like, we can cater to our stars on things we don't necessarily care about on the margins, drafting Bronny, because who cares about 55th pick, signing 12th man, whatever, it doesn't matter. But these big decisions, no. We make our own choices. Even people think, you know, there was an idea that the Lakers hired JJ Redick to be the coach because LeBron, it was his LeBron's podcast partner, and LeBron wanted it. LeBron had nothing to do with it. Like, he wasn't involved at all. That was the Lakers' decision on their own.
You talk about that. You talk about that in the book, where they didn't they communicated during that process, but not about the coaching search.
Oh, JJ and LeBron, you're saying? Yeah, I spoke to the producer from the podcast they did, and the way he phrased it to me is like, as an example, he's like, maybe they talked about it, but what I can tell you is what he told me. What I can tell you is, we had them mic'd up all the time when they were here, not even stuff that made the air. And I even asked my guys out of curiosity, and there was nothing ever them discussing anything about the job. So, like, yeah, I guess they could have had a burner phone, but it just defies logic that would never come up if it was something they were actually discussing.
But I mean, to the Lakers' credit or discredit, whatever it might be, they knew there was a relationship there.
For sure. And the relationship there for the same reasons they wanted to hire him, right? That, like, he's someone, JJ Redick, someone who works hard, is smart, is respected. Like, LeBron was willing to do a podcast with JJ Redick for basically the same reasons that the Lakers wanted to hire him as coach, right? But it doesn't mean that one was done because of the other.
Yeah. What do you, I mean, this is pure speculation. How do you see the JJ Redick tenure going based on the last several hires that Rob Pelinka has had for the Lakers?
It's so interesting because JJ is the first one he's really spent money on. They were going to do it on Hurley too, right? So they don't hire Ty Lue because they don't want to pay. So they hire Frank Vogel, who's a good coach, but, you know, second rate in terms of, like, pay and stature. Darvin Ham's a similar thing, right? He's a, you know, he's a good candidate then, but a similar thing. JJ is the first one where they really pay for a guy, and it's the first coaching star that Pelinka hired, which was interesting. And it was sort of, if you go back, it's really interesting to go back and listen to the original press conference where they announced JJ Redick, and the Lakers were making it very clear what they were doing. They were pivoting away from LeBron, and they were changing their model. They're talking about, Rob Pelinka speaking like he's running the Thunder in a small market team. Like, new salary cap, we're going to lean into player development. They talked about this player development app they were going to make. God knows what happened to that, right? It was just a whole new world. Then Luka falls in their lap and they're back to, like, we chase stars. But they were ready to pivot to a new approach, and that's why they were going to go to Hurley. And JJ Redick was a similar thing. Someone who could, like, look at the organization holistically, and we're going to have a player development plan, and this stuff all goes together. I think JJ is a really good coach. I think he's really smart, really respected, works his butt off. Temper, that's not even the right word. He's going to have to figure out a way to get his emotions in check. Like, we see him calling timeouts, yelling at guys. That's fine. But we literally saw an example in the playoffs of, you know, when he plays five guys the entire second half, whatever game that was against Minnesota, that's to me is an example of somebody unable to regulate their emotions in a way where you can like kind of realize, no, I'm thinking I'm being too reactionary here. This is not a proper way to coach, right? I have to figure out, I know I want to win, but that's inability to regulate your emotions. And we've seen him kind of have these outbursts, and he's talked about having to curtail these. I think that's going to be the one thing we have to pay attention to.
Yeah. Kind of drove him as a player.
Correct. It's one of these things, right? But as a coach, it's there. So he chews out Jackson Hayes the other day. That's fine. Nobody cares about Jackson Hayes. He probably deserved it. I think at a certain point, like, you can't keep doing that to NBA players. It just doesn't last.
Yeah, wears them down. You talk about Rob Pelinka a couple times. I got the impression when you first write about him, he, not that it's your opinion, I don't know what your opinion is, but the general consensus is he's a bit of a buffoon as a GM and quite sanctimonious. And he was picked as the GM primarily because of a relationship with Kobe Bryant and the Lakers, or with Kobe Bryant and Kobe being the, you know, the star of the Lakers. But at the end, he, you know, he's like, oh, we got Luka. Like you said, Luka fell right in their lap. And now he's, you know, some sort of genius trader. And what changed there? The narrative. How did that change? Is it just because of those events, or am I inaccurate with those?
No, I wouldn't say so. He had different skills, right? So he was hired. It's sort of unfair to him, right? Or I mean, depends what you want. He was hired to be sort of the guy with the knowledge and know-how who would be Magic Johnson's right hand man. Magic Johnson didn't have, when he comes in as president of basketball operations, he doesn't have that, right? The experience in that role. And Pelinka's the former agent who's been in the trenches, knows all that stuff. That's gonna be his job. The thing is, Rob Pelinka's skills as an agent were not like knowing the collective bargaining agreement in and out. Like, that wasn't what his thing was. You don't need to know that to represent stars like Kobe.
He's got a guy though. He's got a guy that you mentioned a few times that is his right-hand man for the salary cap stuff.
Correct. Now he does. Yeah. And so when he but at the beginning, that was supposed to be him, right? And that wasn't his expertise. And they messed up the salary cap a few times, and he did as well. What he's really good at, managing up, which sounds like it's a legit thing, right? Being a GM, one of the biggest, most important things is, can you manage your owner and just, you know, manage expectations and filter information and develop trust where they trust you and allow you to go about your job? And he's fantastic at that. Listen, the Luka thing, we say it fell in his lap. It's true, but it's not that he's got Luka. He kept it quiet. I know they want him to, and that was beneficial to him, but he got Luka without trading anything. Like that, or not, like that was the thing. They traded Anthony Davis and one pick, whatever it was. Like that trade should have been Austin Reeves, Anthony Davis, and every single pick the Lakers had. And he probably still would have done that. It would have been the right move, right? So not only does he get him, but he gets him without giving up all the assets that you see normally move in a typical star trade. So there are legit skills there.
Yeah, and Mavericks wanted to, or at least their GM wanted to get rid of him. I think he was, you know, the drinking, the carousing, they couldn't control it. And no, that was not really out, I don't think. And I think, you know, they got sick of him. And the Mavericks fans, I mean, they're not NBA beat reporters. They don't know this stuff. And, you know, so he falls in the Lakers' lap. But it looks like Luka has at least turned the corner a little bit over the summer, got fit for once, and you know, or at least the summer fitness. We'll see what happens over the course of the NBA season. But anyway, I know you got a heart out here momentarily, your own. But where can people find out more about you and get their hands on the book?
Yeah, sure. You get the book wherever books are sold, as they say. So I used to joke, you know, support local bookstores. But I think in today's world, like, just buy a book. Amazon, fine. If you want to support Amazon with books, go ahead. You know, and you can find me on whichever social media is your social media of choice. I'm on all platforms these days.
Yaron Weitzman, we'll have that all in the show notes and all that stuff. Hey, appreciate you spending time with us today here, Yaron, and best of luck with the book. And you know, it's controversy sells, and there's a lot of controversy, so go out and read this book and learn all about what's happening, or what happened with the Lakers and LeBron, etc. So, yeah, best of luck.
Thank you, Brian. Really appreciate it. This was fun. All right, man. Thank you.
Okay, take care. Thanks for tuning in again, folks. Yaron Weitzman with a Hollywood ending, the dreams and drama of the LeBron Lakers. And you can find all you need to know about the book in our show notes. And that will be at our Substack page and our podcast page. You should go to fountain.fm or the Fountain app to download the audio and video version. Fountain is now doing video podcasts. But we'll also have it on X. We'll have it on YouTube and we'll have it on Substack, like I said, all at Brian D. O'Leary. And you can find the Substack at O'LearyReview.com. And once again, thanks for tuning in to Yaron Weitzman, A Hollywood Ending, The Dreams and Drama of the LeBron Lakers. That's Doubleday, October 21st, 2025.